Everything is all right. Please tell me that you're all right. That's Motion City Soundtrack. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. Everything is all right on one hand, and on the other hand, we're waiting to find out if everything is all right. On the positive side, Jays came back from a 3-1 loss on Friday for a kind of small ballish bullpen day, 5-0 victory on Saturday, and then a home run fueled 7-6 victory on Sunday. They take the series against the Guardians. It's their first series win against a team that's above 500 currently since way back in mid-April against the Yankees. It's also at a time when the other teams in that AL wildcard picture are starting to win again as well. So some positive there. You take a series against a very, very good team, shake off a rough start there. Now on the side where, you know, please tell me that you're all right, we're still waiting to hear good news here. Jimmy Garcia left Sunday's game in the ninth inning with elbow soreness. He'd given up a two-run home run. He had put two runners on. Huge credit to Nate Pearson getting out of that jam, coming in late there and picking up the save. However, if Jimmy Garcia is injured, this bullpen that's already been very, very bad and ranks 27th in bullpen ERA is going to be on even shakier ground, because Jordan Romano is still only thrown from 90 feet on flat ground, hasn't even worked back to throwing off a mound yet. Eric Swanson is not pitching particularly well in AAA. If you look at some of the other options down at AAA who could come up, while Hagen Danner, who is probably top of the list, is on the IL, there's a Ryan Burr. There are some of the other guys you've picked up in minor transactions over the course of the year, some length guys, etc. But there's nobody really knocking on that door. Burr, I guess, would be the man who comes back up there, given his numbers and his performance at AAA. Anyway, that's not great. In addition, the team still hasn't been at 500 since April 29th. They haven't been above 500 since April 24th. They're still trying to get there. And they now host a Sox team that is just ahead of them in the standings and just beat the Phillies and Yankees in series this past week. So the degree of difficulty based on record alone gets a little lighter after that Guardian series, but this is a Red Sox team that's coming in playing some pretty good baseball, that stole 9 bases against Jose Trevino and the Yankees last night, and a Red Sox team that is going to start at least 2 pretty good pitchers in this series against the Blue Jays in Nick Pivetta and Tanner Houck. Brian Baio getting the third start there, and even though he's got an ERA of 5, that's a really interesting young pitcher who does a really good job keeping the ball on the ground. So a lot to dissect for this series, a lot to dissect from the Guardian series that was. We're going to do that. We have Chris Cotillo from Mass Live coming on with us in a few minutes here. Chris Black will join us as usual. Jeff Ponce from Baseball America is going to join us at 11 to kind of go around the Blue Jays farm system. A couple minor notes from the weekend. Leo Jimenez is back for AAA Buffalo. Nathan Lucas underwent UCL thumb surgery, so he's out until later this season. And as Doug Fox and I speculated before the weekend, Alan Roden got the bump from AA to AAA, the corresponding move to Addison Barger getting called up to the major. So we'll talk to Jeff about that and a bunch of other things. We'll talk to Davey Andrews from Fangraphs as well. Couple other updates for you from the weekend before we talk to Chris Cotillo. So yeah, Jimmy Garcia left Sunday's game with right elbow soreness. We'll probably get a pregame update from John Schneider today. Bo Bichette also missed the last 2 games with right calf soreness. John Schneider said after the game, hopefully not too much longer for that one, and he was maybe available if they needed him in a reserve role on Sunday. IKF slotting in at shortstop there with Bo Bichette out. You know, probably not the worst idea for Bo Bichette to get a couple head-clearing days as well. Ricky Tiedemann made his first rehab start on his way back at the Florida Complex League. He only went a third of an inning. He gave up 3 runs. First rehab start back, you're not really worried about the results, but we don't get video of Florida Complex League games, so that's all we've got there. I mentioned Jordan Romano threw from 90 feet Friday. Felt good, but that's the latest there. And then the big one, Yariel Rodriguez had his 6th rehab appearance at AAA on Sunday. He went 3 innings, allowed 2 runs with 3 hits, 3 walks, 7 strikeouts. He threw 79 pitches, which is probably the most important thing. He averaged about 93 with the fastball, topped out at 96, did get 13 swing and misses. So once again, the swing and miss stuff was there with multiple pitches, but some control issues in that one that we hadn't really seen on this rehab stint. And of course, some inefficiency of pitches that we have seen when Yariel was up in the majors. So look, realistically, there is nothing left for him to show at the AAA level. He's stretched out. The swing and miss stuff is there. Some of the control issues and, you know, less efficient pitching things that pop up, that's something they're going to have to deal with at the major league level, because they need his arm, whether that's in the 5th starter spot or as an extra bullpen weapon right now. They need that in general, and especially if Jimmy Garcia is going to miss some time here. Okay, so it is the Red Sox in town this weekend. We're going to talk more about the series that was with Chris Black at 10:30. But first, because flights are timed as they are, and the Red Sox were playing some Sunday Night Baseball last night, so our next guest is in a bit of a time crunch here. Let's tee up the Red Sox side of this first. Chris Cotillo, Red Sox beat writer at Mass Live. Chris, how we doing, man? Is this live from the airport?
I am live from the airport at the Porter desk. Very exciting.
Hell yeah. I appreciate you doing it. Appreciate you making out the time. Yesterday was a fun one, man. I do want to talk to you about the Red Sox game, but I know you also, you know, yesterday was Father's Day. You tweeted a cool picture of you and your dad and your grandpa at Fenway. How much is that connection, you know, through your dad and your grandfather tied into your love of baseball and the fact that you've wanted to do this from such a young age?
Yeah, it's everything. You know, the first game that I ever went to was with the two of them and Fenway, and Derek Lowe happened to throw a no-hitter against the Rays that day. So when that's your first experience at 6 years old, you kind of fall in love with it. So, you know, they still, you know, watch, both of them watch every Red Sox game. I think, you know, they're not as jaded as I am now, a few years into being on the beat. So they, you know, still watch and root and stuff. But that's kind of where it all began. So always appreciate that.
On the Father's Day side of things, I know you were at the game, so maybe, I know you saw the clip because you retweeted out. Is Tristan Casas okay? Because for anyone who didn't catch it, Tristan Casas on Sunday Night Baseball last night, and he's on the IL. He gave an interview from the dugout, and he told a story about his dad getting, like, arrested at a youth game because Tristan Casas didn't want to go and play in the field, and his dad grabbed him and, like, booted him, like, physically booted him onto the field. And Tristan Casas told it like it was this very feel-good story about his dad getting, like, child services called on him at a game. Is Tristan Casas okay, man?
Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of what we get. That's the Tristan Casas package that we get whenever we talk to him. He's always providing some nugget or anecdote or crazy story, and it never ends. It's kind of a reporter's dream. He's good for business. He's also good for the Red Sox. But, he, you know, when they mic him up, it's like they got to wrestle the mic away from him every time. And he's got a lot of pent-up, you know, stories right now because he's doing nothing other than, you know, talking and starting to ramp up here after – tearing cartilage in his rib about 2 months ago. So there's a lot going on there. I think he's all right. Never heard that story before, but I'm sure he's got about a billion.
Yeah, so he's still a little bit a ways from returning after that torn rib cartilage. So we'll maybe pocket the Tristan Casas one for the next series or when he's a little closer to a return. Fun one last night, Chris. 9 stolen bases for the Red Sox against Jose Trevino and the Yankees. That is a Boston Red Sox franchise record, and for those who don't know, the Boston Red Sox have existed since like 1400, and I thought we were done setting new Boston Red Sox records at this point. Man, you got to feel for Jose Trevino after that one.
Yeah, the Red Sox have just, you know, come out this year from a different approach, very athletic, quick kind of fast break offense type of thing that they're trying to do, which is different than we've seen in previous years. You know, when you think of the Red Sox offense in the heyday, David Ortiz and Manny Ramirez, I don't really, you know, think that they're 40 times on the back of their baseball cards. But these guys now, it's different. You know, they've been rolling with a top two in the order, Jaron Duran and David Hamilton, who are both really fast. Rafaela can provide some speed. Even, you know, guys like Wong, Abreu, and he's healthy. You know, they want to kind of keep it moving. And that's just been a real focus from Alex Cora, you know, with the rule changes, with everything that's happened in the last couple of years, to try to, you know, get them to play faster, play quicker, play more athletic. And so far they have. And last night, you know, the greatest example of that so far this season. But so they do put pressure on the opposing pitcher. They find ways. You know, Duran is electric kind of in every way. You know, when he gets on the bases, he leads the majors in triples by a lot. You know, I was in St. Louis a couple weeks ago, and he hit a pop-up that Nolan Arenado lost in the sun behind the third base bag. And by the time the ball dropped, Duran was standing on second with a stand-up triple. A little bit crazy on the official scoring, but if he didn't touch the ball, it counts as a hit. So we've seen that all year. And again, last night was pretty remarkable.
So you mentioned Alex Cora kind of wants them to play this way. He had some quotes after the game that I know you included in your story about kind of, yeah, you look over in the other dugout and you can see that the impact that's having. The Jays are fresh off a series against the Brewers, who obviously believe very similarly and have a couple of guys who can run. So how much should we expect to see this? Like the Blue Jays, the Blue Jays catchers are a lot like Jose Trevino in that they're both very, very good defensively in terms of framing and blocking, and they get rave reviews from their pitching staff. But when it comes to controlling the run game, and we know the pitchers often give up the stolen base more so than the catchers. The catchers are just kind of trying to erase the damage, but the Blue Jays catchers haven't done that at a high-end level. Should we expect to see a bunch of this from the Red Sox again if they can get guys on?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is sometimes getting on base. I mean, you see that throughout the year. You know, sometimes the offense isn't clicking. You know, they have, as I said, Costas is down, but Story is down, Abreu is down right now. You know, they have a few guys that are, you know, filling in, you know, at first base, Dom Smith pretty much every day. Second base, they have the worst OPS in baseball with Emmanuel Valdez and Jamie Westbrook, who spent 11 years in the minors. You know, they're kind of platooning right now with Vaughn Grissom out yet again. He wasn't hitting. So, you know, there is, you know, an extended black hole in the lineup a lot of times when Bobby Dalbec plays. He hasn't hit all year. So, you know, the struggle is getting guys on. But if they can get, you know, Duran, Hamilton, Wong, some of these guys that have been producing offensively on, it's kind of off to the races. And I think, you know, like I said, they're just going to want to try to continue putting pressure on the opponent if they can.
So you were, look, this is a good week for the Red Sox. They won that series against the Yankees. They won a series against the Phillies. I know you were on foul territory this week, and you said that, yeah, the Red Sox are overperforming. You just kind of mentioned it. Hey, Tristan Costas is on the IL. A couple guys have under, there are a couple slots in the lineup underperforming. You know, a handful of other guys on the IL as well. What do you think has gone into this Red Sox? Like, obviously, the stolen bases are nice, but it's not like they're the Cincinnati Reds. Like, they're fifth in stolen bases after last night. That's a nice thing to have. It's not the only explanation. This Red Sox team being able to, you know, and I don't even think people were, like, crazy high on them coming into the season, but for them to deal with all that and continue to underperform, be a little above 500 here, what do you think's made that possible for this group?
Just the starting pitching, especially at the beginning of the year, you know, Tanner Houck looks like an ace. Cutter Crawford was really good for the first month. You know, Bayo and Pivetta have had their ups and downs, but even a guy like Cooper Criswell stepped in the rotation with Whitlock and Giolito out for the season. And I think they're 8-3 in his starts or 9-3 in his starts. A guy who was, you know, DFA'd by the Rays during the winter, picked up for $1 million, and like has been keeping the Red Sox in games, you know, not going 7 shutout, but giving them 5 shutouts here and there. You know, the other night, 2 runs and 4 innings before they turn it over to the bullpen and unleash, you know, some of the electric arms they have there. Slayton's been really good out of the bullpen. Kelly's been really good. We saw that last night. They've had a lot of kind of bit pieces step up with a lot of their guys down. And, you know, I think the new brand of baseball is nice. But at the end of the day, the pitching has really exceeded expectations. They've hit a wall a little bit. As I said, Bayo and Pivetta, their last turns were not very good. We'll see Pivetta, obviously, in Toronto. But generally, the starters have kept them in games. You know, the bullpen hasn't blown too many. You know, when they've lost, it's because the offense has gone silent with some of those holes that I was talking about. But they're getting back to full strength. You know, Abreu should be back by the end of the week. Romy Gonzalez, the utility man that they like, should be active tonight. He's been on the IL like 3 times, but he gives them, you know, more speed when he does play. So they do like him. And, you know, takes a pass away from Westbrook and Dalbec, who are not really major league players. So I think it's just been, you know, the offense hasn't given them what they thought they would with some of these guys down, but the pitching staff has.
You mentioned Nick Pivetta. Let's dig in on him a little bit because he's going to start tonight. Also, a little CanCon here, a Canadian guy pitching against the Jays in Toronto is always fun. Mm-hmm. You know, solid overall numbers, 388 ERA, pretty good K rate, keeps the walks low until recently, and we know that he's always been a bit of a home run trouble guy. The walks that have creeped back in lately, is that the primary issue here? Like, all the stuff and pitch modeling metrics and things like that still say, yeah, Nick Pivetta has been terrific. You know, the pitches look good, the movement's good, the velocity's pretty good. Is this just the controls gotten away from him a little bit the last little while?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with him is that he's just consistently inconsistent throughout his whole career. You see the ceiling and you see, you know, for example, like 2 outings ago against the Braves, 7 innings, 9 strikeouts against a great lineup. The other night against the Phillies, he was terrible. You know, we see that kind of back and forth where he is excellent and then the next day he's bad. And I don't know, you know, what goes into it. I think this is a guy that they've been facing the ceiling on for years. If he puts together a good year, he's going to get a huge contract in free agency because some of the stuff he mentioned, the under-the-hood numbers, all that. You know, he's a, you know, StatCast darling and all that. But, you know, the results bear out always to an average pitcher. If you look at how he was last year, expecting big things out of the rotation, was so bad he got bumped out of the rotation by the end of May. went into the bullpen and was like the best pitcher in baseball history for 2 months in a bulk role coming out of the bullpen after an opener. You know, strikeout numbers were ridiculous, partially because he got to face the A's like twice. And then he came back and was okay as a starter in September. And it always kind of bears out to that, like he's a 4.15, 4.20 ERA guy. There's a lot riding on him in the next few weeks for the Red Sox because, you know, I think despite the good week they had, despite, you know, being in it and being two games up over 500 right now, I do think they're probably sellers at the trade deadline. And if they are, Nick Pavetta's their best piece just because a starting pitcher, every team can look at those under the hood numbers, want to get him in their lab, so to speak. And so if he has a good couple weeks here, or a good few starts here, then he could get a lot at the trade deadline. He's pitching for a contract for the first time in his career. You know, this guy's been around a while, but he's finally about to hit free agency. And, you know, a lot of teams are going to, like I said, want to pay up for him if, you know, he has a good end of the year here.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought because, you know, the fact that he has played the starter and bullpen role, you'd think at the trade deadline makes him super attractive, right? The teams that maybe have three starters already but want someone who can help them finish out the string, get to the playoffs, and then maybe move to a bulk role. You know, this year's Michael Lorenzen, but obviously with a higher stuff profile there. So that's interesting. On the bullpen side, this has been a pretty good bullpen. It sounds like they'll also get Chris Martin back this week. Chris Martin pitched against Toronto's AAA affiliate, Buffalo, yesterday. It sounded like, you know, Tuesday is probably the target date for Chris Martin to come off the IL. How has the team handled this? So for anyone who doesn't know, Chris Martin has been on the IL with a mental health related issue, not a physical health related issue. So how has the team handled that? How do they handle it, you know, from a reintegration standpoint and making sure this is something that Chris Martin can manage the rest of the way?
Yeah, it's, you know, I think, first of all, credit to him for stepping up and, you know, letting that be the label on the injured list, right? Anxiety, not, you know, my arm sore or something. You know, he talked to Julian McWilliams of the Globe the other day and said, you know, wasn't always the manly thing to do, but, you know, 2024 and, you know, people deal with this. And so credit to him and credit to the Red Sox for supporting him and, you know, being open about the conversation. It just helps other athletes and people in all walks of life, obviously, you know, be comfortable talking about that. I think, you know, with him, this has been a short-term thing. You know, they shut him. They never really shut him down. He's been around the team the whole time. He's been throwing bullpens. He obviously threw in Buffalo yesterday. So they just kind of took him off the roster to deal with, you know, anxiety. And he just felt like he was tired all the time and not sleeping and dealing with what, you know, whatever he was. And but it wasn't like he left the team and, you know, spent a few weeks away. He has been around and, like I said, pitched yesterday. So they expect him to be back, and, you know, he hasn't missed much time. It's just the minimum 15 days once he comes back. Tuesday is the goal, and, you know, I think he'll be, obviously, you know, he's been up and down this year, but if you look at his numbers last year, one of the most elite seasons you'll ever see from a reliever. He basically didn't give up a run after June 1st, so they're hoping he can be something like that down the stretch. And also another guy who could be a great trade chip to know if they do so.
Yeah, not only did he not give up a run from, like, June onward, I don't think he threw a ball that didn't get chased. I don't know that he walked right. Anyone the whole way there. Okay, so Chris Martin, I'll add back to that bullpen. That bullpen has been pretty solid, but it got a little shaky on the weekend. Is it a true story that you relayed in your piece that Kenley Jansen called Alex Cora from the bullpen and was like, let me go. Like, I haven't pitched a four-out save since July 1st of last year, but I'm ready to do this against the Yankees.
I guess so. You know, this is a guy that's really not been used. He pitched on three straight Sundays without being, you know, used until he went Wednesday and got the save. So, you know, he's kind of raring to go. They've just been, you know, not in a ton of save situations for whatever reason for a team that's above 500. So he's fresh. You know, they hope that'll help them as the spring turns to summer here, and, you know, have him have, you know, more bullets than you'd probably, you know, have in other seasons. He went out through two great innings in Chicago last Sunday in a non-save situation, gave him six outs. So he's built up and looking good.
And the best part is he got Anthony Volpe out in that big situation there. So, you know, Jays fans and Red Sox fans don't agree on very much, but I think needling Anthony Volpe and the Yankee fans about Volpe is some common ground there. Chris, you had mentioned Tanner Houck a little earlier. I'll ask you about him now just because we'll see him tomorrow and I won't talk to you before then. 2.08 ERA. He has just stopped walking anyone. Really good ground ball rate. You said it. He's looked like an ace. How much are we buying that Tanner Houck can be, you know, a front of the rotation guy versus this kind of fringier guy we saw the last couple of years where there was potential there, but, you know, back and forth to the bullpen, not a great 2023 overall?
Yeah, he's throwing strikes. That's been something that has been kind of missing for his entire career, you know, and something that they're, I think, you know, very happy about. So, you know, so far so good with him. I think that's been the most positive step and the most positive sign for the Red Sox the entire year. They've been looking for a homegrown ace for a while, and he's a guy that, you know, if you look at all the numbers, is going to be, you know, legitimately in the mix to start the All-Star game. You can't ask for much more. I mean, he really hasn't had a bad start. You know, the three knocks on him, other than health, and there's been some freak stuff. I mean, last year he got hit in the face with a comebacker right around this time and missed 2 months. And that kind of, you know, was a huge setback, obviously. But the three knocks on him were not throwing strikes, not having a third pitch to be a weapon, and not putting deep into games. All those things, obviously, you know, play into each other. And this year, the split has been excellent to add to the slider, which is already elite, and the sinker. And then you have, you know, him pitching 6-7 innings every time out without fail. He's gone at least 5 in every outing. And he's thrown strikes and been able to get soft contact and do that. So, and he's a writer's dream because, you know, sometimes he'll pitch and the game is like an hour and 49 minutes. So you can't ask for more than that.
Perfect. Yeah, nod to the Mark Burleys and Roy Halladays of the world. Chris, last one before I let you go get your flight. This is a bit off the board because we won't see this person in this series, obviously, but prospect Cutter Coffee for the Red Sox homered in 6 consecutive games recently. Time to bump him up from high A to double A or what?
Yeah, there's a lot of guys that are kind of pushing, you know, mainly I think the big three prospects everybody talks about here, Roman Anthony, Kyle Teal, and Marcelo Meyer. But, you know, the organization's in a good spot. They've got a lot of guys, you know, having pretty good performances so far this year. So, you know, big league team that's hanging around and, you know, the prospects in a lot of places looking good. You know, it's a good mix to have. That's what they've been trying to do instead of spending for the last few years. So the attention, like I said, is on the big three, but there's other good prospects in the system too.
Yeah, well, that's exciting for them. I'm sure Red Sox fans would rather they spend and do both, but nice to have those reinforcements coming. Nice to talk to you, Chris. I'll see you down at the park a little later. Travel safe.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Chris Cotillo, Red Sox beat writer at Mass Live, live from Porter on his way to Toronto for this series. So, yeah, it should be a fun one. Nick Pivetta going tonight. Obviously, some CanCon there. There's the CanCon in Tyler O'Neill as well. So, nice, a couple nice stories there for the Red Sox. Pivetta's an interesting one. We're going to talk more about this with Chris Black in a minute here. But the Red Sox league-wide have basically ditched the four-seam fastball. They throw it only 16.3% of the time across their entire staff. That is by far the lowest four-seam fastball rate in baseball. Now, they've countered that by throwing more cut fastballs than anyone else. So basically, they've just traded in four-seamers for cutters. If you look at four-seamers and cutters and sinkers all together, like in this bucket of fastballs, they're about average. But that change from four-seamers to cutters has not included Nick Pivetta. Nick Pivetta, by the underlying metrics, has the second best fastball in baseball after only Mason Miller. It's not, you know, that Mason Miller 101 every time out, but he gets that terrific ride, that kind of, hey, it looks like it stays up in the zone and stays up on you. That's something some Blue Jays have struggled with. David Schneider's been pretty good against it this year, which is interesting because the book on David Schneider initially was maybe he's going to have trouble with those high fastballs. So a fun matchup thing there. And then just a fun thing in general with Nick Pivetta being just so counter to what the Red Sox are doing with other parts of their organizational strategy when it comes to the fastball. I think the takeaway there is, yeah, we're going to move from the four-seamer to the cutter and sinker more unless you have a fastball as good as Nick Pivetta's, which ranks only behind Mason Miller's in terms of some of those pitch modeling metrics. That's a pretty good spot to be. I don't think you're – if a guy has a fastball that ranks as the number two fastball in baseball, I don't think you're going to get him to buy in on, hey, maybe you should throw the cutter instead. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Chris Black about it. Let's break down some of this Guardian series as well and continue setting up this Red Sox one as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little Tokyo Police Club there for you and for our next guest, Chris Black, who will join us in a minute here. Fun little lineup at a Hamilton Music Festival in a couple weeks coming up here, right before Major League Baseball's All-Star Break, July 13, 14, 15, or 12, 13, 14, whatever that weekend is. Yeah, Tokyo Police Club, Dizzy, Cuff the Duke, a couple bands that Chris always has us play. My guys at Pop are playing, Billy Talent. What a loaded show. This is not a promotional thing. I'm just enjoying some music. It was also North by Northwest this weekend, which I got to go out and take in a little bit of as well. Also took in some Blue Jays and Guardians. Jays took 2 of 3, 7-6 win yesterday. Tough one in the end when you may have lost Jimmy Garcia in addition to all the other bullpen guys you have lost to date. Let's see how Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, king of the threads at Down to Black, is feeling about it. Chris, before we talk any Blue Jays stuff, you working on your 4-foot putts today just to make sure if any big situations come up, you know, any majors on the line or anything like that, you've got the gimmies ready to go?
No, it's it was a busy weekend, and it's a busy week for me as well. There's all sorts of stuff going on. That we had a great Father's Day thing. There's no golf happening. There is an automobile issue, which I will not dive into on public airwaves.
All right. Well, no golf for you then, but happy Father's Day belatedly there as well. And to all the fathers, I did want to ask you, so I know you're a big golf guy, and this isn't a golf show. I'm not a huge golf guy. But that segment that I guess viral's the term for it, but with Bryson DeChambeau after the championship and Johnson Wagner, the recent player turned broadcaster, having that segment, and I'm sorry to anyone who didn't see it, but basically Johnson Wagner was asking Bryson DeChambeau about the up and down shot out of the bunker on 18 that won him the U.S. Open, and then Johnson Wagner sticks one while they're talking about it within a foot. They obviously have a relationship. This is kind of like, I was going to ask you, like, that's a producer's dream, right? But you couldn't even plan that out. Like there's no way you could be like, man, that would be cool. Like, that's such a happenstance. I don't know. It just struck me as something you would really appreciate as a golf fan and as a producer.
100%. It's not, you can't plan for an event like that, but what you can do is have the right kind of people working on your events, and that's exactly what that was. It's a really personable analyst. It's an analyst with good relationships with lots of players. It's a guy who can think on the fly, and he wasn't afraid to have real moment. Like, there was even a moment, like, if he was purely in broadcaster mode, he would have stuck to the conversation, would have stuck to talking about how to hit the shot, but like, even like stopped while he was doing that segment to be like, hey man, like, congratulations. Like, that was amazing, which is just like a human thing to do. And like, it was just a really, it's, you can't plan for luck to happen like that, but you can just be prepared. And you can be ready when those moments come. And if you have the right people, then the right moments tend to be almost like magnified, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It's fun to think of a baseball equivalent, although I doubt very much even our very good broadcasters would like get live pitching to redo a home run or something like that. So
no one's throwing 90 anymore.
No, I don't think so. Okay, so Jays had a fun weekend series. Friday was more than a little frustrating against one of, you know, and like statistically and by stuff and things like that, and just to watch him, one of the worst pitchers in baseball, Logan Allen, kind of befuddled the Blue Jays there. But then they got it going. On Saturday, it was a little bit more piecemeal, you know, kind of not small ball, but small ball-ish, and a really good bullpen day. And then yesterday, the power bats got going a little bit. Ernie Clement had himself a weekend. Speaking of golf, he told me he shot 74 at TPC Osprey on the off day on Thursday, which pretty good. That's pretty good.
I will say Caleb Joseph shot like 76 or something last week somewhere.
Okay.
So not to speak on other people's scores, I have not broken 80, so I can't say anything. But yeah, there's some players around this team.
Yeah, neither have I. I've broken 90 once, and that was several years ago. Not a great golfer over here. But Ernie Clement, you know, rolled that into a pretty good weekend. Couple doubles on Friday, home run yesterday. You know, he's had a bit of a rough go this season offensively, to where at times it looked like maybe he might be the, you know, kind of next guy out in some of these roster crunch decisions. Back came around this weekend. What are you seeing from Ernie Clement?
I'm seeing, like, usually I'm a numbers guy, but, like, I think it's worth pointing out that I wonder how much of the recent roster moves have maybe given this guy just a little bit of extra confidence, a little bit of security, a little bit of calmness, whatever you want to call it. Because, you know, we'll never know how close he might have been or whether he was even considered to be among the guys who might go for a Barger. But, you know, he's done it. We've always known that the bat to ball skills were there. The fielding even was strangely kind of inconsistent to start the year, but he's given them a dose of energy, three straight starts, three straight multi-hit games. Like, he's hitting, and he's just like, the vibes do seem from the outside looking in good when a guy like him and the Horowitzes and the Schneiders of the world, the vibes seem good, right? Like, there's no other way of putting it. And again, I'd love to be more analytic with him, but I think it's contact ability. That much we know. He's going to swing a lot. He's going to chase a lot. And I do think, as we've seen, he's not nearly the same level of hitter as Bo, but like, when you have a swing heavy profile, you're going to go through cold stretches, mm-hmm. right? Like, when you're a ball and play guy who's not a big power guy, like, you're going to go through stretches where you hit the mat people, and you kind of, it can be like a multi-week thing. But so I do like him. I do think he's kind of validated some of the faith that the org has showed in him over the last week or two. So that's all good to see. Cause if, you know, wins are good in this for this team. They'll take any wins they can get right now.
Well, and that's part of the vibes thing too, right? Is like, yeah, the vibes seem really good. They've also won a bunch of baseball games recently, at least enough to get back within a game of 500 here. But no, you're right. I think there's a big component to that. You know, obviously, you know, Davis, Ernie, and Spencer being kind of reunited, but the bigger factor of, you might have thought you were the 13th man and you were the next guy out, and now, you know, at worst, you were the 11th man because two other guys have gotten let go. You know, also, hey, Bo's calf injury has maybe got him in the lineup once or twice more. And you mentioned it, those bat-to-ball guys that are going to ride the waves of batting average on balls in play a little bit. Do they drop in? Do they find a glove? Well, when you get to play 3 days in a row, those can balance out a little bit more than if you're playing, you know, once a week, twice a week. So, yeah, we like to do the numbers on the show, but it's a very human game. And I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, right? You just kind of get a second to exhale. Hey, I'm here. I can get back to focusing on my stuff, and the results kind of follow from there. Dalton Varsho also had a big one in that game. He got three different cracks at it with the bases loaded in that game. Comes up in the first with the bases loaded and one out. The Jays had loaded the bases to start the game with nobody out. They got no runs, of course, and then they scored a bunch in the second inning, which, even though the streak is over, we're still dealing with this. I don't know. You can't do anything in the first, and then the second explodes. He also came up in the eighth with the bases loaded and two outs and struck out. But in the fifth inning, bases loaded, nobody out, he hits a grand slam. That ended up being probably the biggest moment of the game, given what happened from the Cleveland coming back perspective. 11 homers on the season, 35 RBI, a 116 weighted runs created plus. So when we adjust for park factors and league factors and things like that, that would be a career best if the season ended today. And, you know, on pace for another 4 to 4.5 win season. What are you liking about Varsho at the plate right now? Obviously, again, another guy who there's going to be some hots and colds given the swing, the heavier swing profile. But, ran into one at a really good time yesterday.
Yeah, what stands out to me, what we're noticing with Varsho, is what he's doing in clutch moments this year. And you can splice that up however you like, whether it's high leverage, whether it's late and close, whether it's runners on, two outs and runners in scoring position. If you look at any of those types of numbers, he's really coming through in the clutch. His OPS is around 1,000 in late and close situations. Two outs and runners in scoring position, it's really, really good. And 8 of his home runs have come with runners on base this year. So that helps the RBI totals, obviously. Like, that's, I think, it's definitely top 10 in baseball. It's, I believe, the next closest on the Jays is Schneider with 5, then Vladdy at 3, and nobody else is higher than 2. So he's come through with runners on base, which is I don't think it's a measurable, repeatable skill, but it definitely helps the season go well for you, right? And it's a skill that this team collectively has struggled with in the past few years. So to have one guy that's coming through in the clutch, I mean, that's huge, right? And the other thing that stands out is the is his batted ball profile, right? Which we've, you know, we all know at this point, he's the lefty Danny Jansen, or the Jansen's the righty Dylan Varsho, but he pulls the ball as much as anyone. When he puts that fastball that he hit the home run off of yesterday, was a fastball up, but on the outer edge. And he's still kind of, there are certain guys who can do that. There's not a lot of guys who can do that, but go get a fastball on the outside corner and kind of whip that bat head around and still pull it for a home run. So batted ball profile, he's sticking with what he does best, and he's coming through in the clutch. So when you add those things to the things we already know about and talked about a lot last year when he struggled to hit, the fielding and the base running, it's just good to see. And like you said, he's on pace to be, I'm pretty sure, I haven't checked in the last few days, but I'm pretty sure he leads the team in wins above replacement. So he's, in terms of wins above replacement, he's tops on the Jays or close to it. He's a top 30, I want to say, position player in baseball. And then because of those clutch things, if you look at like win probability added, which is a nerdy way of looking at how much a guy is really contributing to helping his team's chances of winning go up with what he's doing, he's among the league's best. So he's coming through in the clutch, and he's doing all the little things throughout the game. So you have to be happy with what he's giving you as a Blue Jays fan this season.
Yeah, you are. And you're right, by the way. He is first on the team in wins above replacement, at least by the Fangraphs metric. Yusei Kikuchi, the only guy who's particularly close. And in terms of win probability added, he's tops. And I hate to say this one, given what happened yesterday, Jimmy Garcia, the only guy who's close in that one. We can maybe talk about that in a minute, but I did want to talk about a couple Red Sox trends to tee this one up. So overall, the Red Sox are a team that, and this seems very much like an organizational philosophy, because the difference between them and everyone else is so extreme. They throw, their pitchers as a staff throw a four-seam fastball, a standard straight fastball, only 16% of the time. That's by far the lowest in baseball. They throw by far the most cut fastballs. Now, we have to set that up because it's part of the series. Weirdly, like from a conversational perspective, Nick Pivetta is the outlier. He still throws his fastball a ton because it's one of the best fastballs in baseball. So let's leave Pivetta out of it for a second. But this team-wide trend from four-seamers to cutters, what do you make of it? What are you looking for in this series? And we're going to see the Sox twice in short order here. So what are you looking for over the next 10 days or so?
Well, this is I really love talking about this because Mike Petriello, I usually give him a few ideas for Blue Jay segments when he's on Blue Jay Central with us. That's kind of a producer's job to at least talk about what he wants to do and narrow down what we're going to talk about. This is one that worked the other way. Mike has a great article up on MLB about the Red Sox fastballs, how little they're using them, not only four-seamers, but four-seamers and sinkers. No team's ever been below 40% for four-seamers and sinkers, and they are well below this year. Like, they are the outlier of outliers. It is really interesting, and Mike explains, he has such a knack for explaining things in a really easily digestible way. And one of the things I really liked about how he explained this was they're not against fastballs. They're against bad fastballs. And Nick Pivetta is a great example because Nick's, as you mentioned in the first segment today, Nick's fastball ranks as one of the league's best in terms of stuff plus, in terms of what it does. And that's because of high spin, it carries the zone, all that stuff that we always talk about. So Nick Pivetta's fastball usage hasn't really changed. They like his fastball. It's a very good pitch. So yeah, they're not saying don't throw fastballs if you have a good one. It's if you throw average ones or below average ones, don't throw them, which sounds very simplistic, but it's really worked for them. And the other thing that I really like about this and what the Red Sox are doing is it's not about velocity. Their fastball, the fastballs that they're throwing this year and having great results off of in terms of opponent slugging or run value, however you want to measure it, they're still not high up in average velocity. So it's not like they've cut down on guys who can't throw hard and have brought in a bunch of guys who throw really hard fastballs. This is about shape pitch, this is about pitch shape. This is about command. This is about putting it in the right spots. And they're having a ton of success. This was a team that was bottom 10, I want to say, in ERA last year, and they're top 10 this year. They're doing really, really well when they throw fastballs, and they're just not throwing any. To me, this is the extreme version of modern pitching, and they're just taking it further than anyone else really has before.
And it's similar to a conversation I had the other week with Justin Choi of Fangraphs. He had written about how a lot of pitchers now have to have two versions of their fastball to succeed, between the fastball, the sinker, and the cutter. And a reason for that is, well, now we can kind of say, in this environment, if your fastball isn't this level of velocity, or you're not one of those high spin, high in the zone, long extension guys that have driven the Jays fans nuts the last 2 years, the Bailey Obers of the world, if you're not one of those guys, maybe it does make sense to trade in the fastball for a sinker, for a cutter. And I know you consider the cutter kind of in between a fastball and a breaking ball, conversation for another day. In terms of how the Jays approach this, again, Pivetta tonight, we're going to see a lot of the fastballs, a lot of those ones up in the zone. Davis Schneider's done well with those. Everyone else kind of eh. And then against the cutter, the only guys who have been like pretty good against right-handed cutters for this Blue Jays team are Spencer Horwitz and Ernie Clement, who have very tiny sample of it. This is something that Kiermaier, Varsho, Bo Bichette, Danny Jansen, they've all kind of struggled with. And it's a smallish sample because cutters don't get thrown a ton. But what are you looking for from the Blue Jays? Again, Pivetta kind of aside, since he's the outlier here, but what is the approach difference, or what are you looking for matchup-wise with how the Jays try to handle this?
Yeah, cutters are interesting because there is a little bit of a, it depends on who, what pitcher you're talking about in terms of, is it closer to a fastball or is it closer to a breaking ball or somewhere in between? A Class A or a Kenley Jansen, it's probably closer to a fastball. But with a lot of guys, it's probably closer to a baby slider. So it's kind of a case by case, but probably trends more towards being a closer to a breaking ball. But what stands out for me with the Jays is they've seen a ton of cutters this year, and whether this is something the league is picking up on or if it's just a kind of a small sample bias of who they've faced this year, but they've seen more cutters by percentage than any other team in baseball. Mm-hmm. And they do not hit them well. Now, obviously, the Blue Jays have struggled to hit against a lot of different pitches this year, but they have been good against breaking balls. That's probably where they've been best. And they have been better against fastballs lately. But batting average off cutters, slugging percentage off cutters, hard hit rate off cutters, run value, they're all like bottom two or three in baseball. So this is actually a matchup this week. It'll be interesting to watch because Red Sox throw more cutters than any other team in baseball. Blue Jays have seen more cutters than any other team in baseball, and they don't hit them well. So this will be a kind of, are we going to buck the trend, or is this going to be something where it's kind of fit or set up for the Blue Jays hitters to struggle a little bit this week?
So another part of this matchup where the Blue Jays could struggle is controlling the run game. The Red Sox stole 9 bases last night. They're 5th in the league overall after that one. Jose Trevino, I said it earlier in the show, he's a little bit like the Blue Jays catchers in that he's an unbelievable blocker and framer, gets good reviews from his pitching staff and stuff like that. But when it comes to the throwing game, Danny Jansen and Alejandro Kirk aren't bottom of the league, but they're not going to erase the fact that some of the Blue Jays pitchers are slower to the mound. And if that timing's not there, we heard Pat Murphy of the Brewers talk about that the Jays being a little slower to the mound out of the bullpen in that double steal situation. So we've seen this play out. What are you looking for from Jansen and Kirk, or is this one where more you think it's more on the pitching staff to be hyper aware of this stuff?
Good question. It really is hard to parse that stuff out, for sure. Now, Kikuchi is probably the best possible option for the Blue Jays to be starting game one on a day after the Red Sox are kind of feeling spry and stole 9 bases on national television. Like, Kikuchi's a really good option to have on the mound. He kind of slows down opposing teams' running games more than any other Blue Jays pitcher. But having said that, like, if this is going to kind of reveal itself during this week's series, it's going to be when Kevin Gausman is on the mound on Wednesday. Gausman, I believe, is probably Statcast tries to parse out this stuff by looking at kind of how long a pitcher takes to get to the plate. Not only that kind of time, which is usually somewhere between 1.3, 1.7 seconds, but it's also about what I like about their numbers is they kind of bake into account how good of a move these guys might have getting over to first base, because how they can measure that are the leads that runners are willing to take against them, and the time that gets baked in terms of the time pitchers get to the plate is kind of where the runners are once the pitcher releases the ball. So by those metrics, Gausman is one of the least effective pitchers at controlling the run game. I think it's behind only Corbin Burns of the Orioles. And that's a good point. Like, looking at those names, those are two good pitchers. Like step one to controlling the running game is just not letting very many base runners get on. So that, like, that's always a great way of mitigating this kind of stuff. But the only other thing that stands out from the StatCast stuff is, as a team, the Blue Jays rank right near the bottom, like 29th, I think, as a pitching staff in terms of controlling the running game. So it is a case where I do think it is more on the pitchers. I do think Kirk and Jansen, they don't have crazy arm strength, but what they do have, their arms have been really, really accurate when they've been trying to catch base runners outside of that first and third situation in Milwaukee last week.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. And Gausman's a good, we know Gausman's a little slower and more deliberate to the plate. You know, there's also an element when it's Corbin Burns, say, you know, I don't have my stopwatch out. Maybe he is a little slower to the plate. But also, if it's an elite pitcher, the risk is probably worth it a little bit more, because you're not going to string 3, 4, 5 hits together. You might not get that 3-run home run. Getting that extra 90 feet, possibly a little extra valuable. If you're the Minnesota Twins or the Texas Rangers, getting on second on Kevin Gausman is also maybe extra valuable, given those two teams' ability to pick up something from him from second base a little bit there. The Jays, by the way, tied for 9th in the most stolen bases allowed this year, although they are near the middle top of the league in caught stealings as well. They're tied for 12th. So teams just run on the Blue Jays a lot here, and the kind of caught stealing rate is somewhere comes out in the wash a little bit. Jays could try to tilt that back a little bit and run on the Red Sox, but you know, we talked about that last time. The Jays just don't have a ton of that there. So I did want to ask you one more. We got 3 minutes left here with you. If Jimmy Garcia is hurt, and if anyone missed it, he left yesterday's game in the 9th inning. He gave up a 2-run home run, put 2 runners on, called out for right elbow soreness. He looked like he was laboring anyway, but calls out for that. Jordan Romano still only throwing from 90 feet. Eric Swanson is not pitching particularly well in AAA. Even a guy like Hagen Danner on the AAA IL, like, it's probably Ryan Burr is the next man up just for a body. But what does this bullpen look like for, let's just say, even this week, if Jimmy Garcia is unavailable?
It's going to be hard for them. Like, this is like, point number one on why you can never have too much pitching depth, right? Like, if before the season, we all would have said, like, the Blue Jays' biggest strength this season is their pitching depth. That when you combine not only all the bullpen depth they had, but 5 viable starters to start the season in Baden Francis in that 5 role, you had Manoah, you had Tiedemann, you have all these guys, and just the amount of gut, like, it also just makes it kind of absurd how healthy they were in over the last couple of years pitching wise. And that's a testament to their training staff and their pitching group, who just, you know, we follow those things. And on a day-to-day basis, those of us on the sidelines love to lament when a guy gets taken out at 90 pitches or something like that. And we're like, let the guy go longer, but they found a way to keep these guys healthy in a industry where it's incredibly hard to keep pitchers healthy. In terms of what they do, like, I don't know. Like, I think it's going to be leaning on Chad Green, right? Like, if Jimmy showed us anything in his, now, if he's dealing with physical ailments, that's something else. But, like, we talked about this recently, like, getting those last 3 outs is hard, and not everyone has the mental makeup to do it, right? And not saying that Jimmy doesn't, but it's just harder to do. And, you know, giving up the odd home run, I think that happens more often. But if I've seen anything from Chad Green from the sidelines, is that it doesn't seem like his, you know, heart rate, his resting heart rate gets very high out there. He just seems very calm, very poised, and his stuff looks good. So I think it's going to be leaning on Chad Green. I like how Chad, I thought Nate Pearson did a good job. I thought he got bailed out by a pretty bad swing decision there in that at bat. But yeah, I think it's going to be generally leaning on Chad Green a lot.
Yeah. That's several guys down the ladder there than we expect at the start of the year. Been a tough go. Chris Black, thanks for taking the time out this morning. I know it's been a tough go this morning for you. I hope the rest of the day goes a little more swimmingly.
Yeah, we'll see if I'm taking a rental car down to the Rogers Center tonight.
Chris Black, at Down to Black, producer at Sportsnet. Thank you for taking the time out. it's going to be a fun series. It's going to be a lot on the catchers. It's going to be a lot on a makeshift bullpen if the Blue Jays, are going to get bad news on Jimmy Garcia here today. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to take a look down on the farm, not to guys who could immediately help, but a little deeper. We'll talk to Jeff Ponce of Baseball America, who is in the process of updating Baseball America's top 100 for the midseason. And he is the Blue Jays checker there. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues. Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Busy weekend for the Blue Jays. Busy week on the farm as well. Nathan Lucas hitting the IL for AAA Buffalo. Leo Jimenez coming back for that team. Alan Roden getting promoted from AA to AAA. Yariel Rodriguez making another rehab appearance, getting stretched out to 79 pitches. Not the most effective of rehab outings, but his sixth rehab outing. Getting very, very close there if he's not ready already. And then, of course, because it was a weekend that exists and because Aurelvis Martinez does what Aurelvis Martinez does, he hit his 16th home run of the minor league season. Hasn't made it Aaron a little bit. The reports I've gotten are the defense still a little shaky. Second and third, still some platoon split stuff where he's doing most of his damage off lefties, but still encouraging to see him hit yet another home run, his 16th. Let's take a look down elsewhere on the farm. Let's tag in Jeff Ponce of Baseball America. He joins us now. Jeff, how we doing, man?
Pretty good, man. How you doing?
I am good. So you told me the other day that you guys are in the process, and I know this because it's where the calendar is. You guys do your preseason top 100 and your rankings for each team's farm system, and then there's going to be a midseason update. Where are you in that process? What's that process like?
Yeah, so, typically, obviously, we have the off season where we put together the handbook and, you know, we spend a lot of time writing those reports and putting everything together. And then by the end of March, I'll have it drawn and we got to reassess a little bit. So we do sort of our first update. That was at the end of April, beginning of May. Really, a lot of that was just guys who got moved out. Maybe a guy like Zulueta, who's no longer with the organization. We swap that out. We might make a couple of changes, move some players on. This is a bigger update. So we'll spend, 3 to 4 weeks sort of beating the bushes, talking to scouts, talking to analysts, talking to front offices, with the teams that we're creating rankings for, as well as opposing teams, to get, a really holistic picture of how the game, people in the game, are feeling about these different prospects and how they would rank them out. There's obviously a lot of variation within there, but I think, now we have over 2 months of the season behind us. We have spring training behind us, of course, so we have a pretty good sample size. And if any of these guys have improved in any ways, regressed in any ways, we're able to address that. So I would say this is our first and maybe one of our biggest ranking updates of the season. We'll then do another one right before the trade deadline, and then another one sort of after the trade deadline when the smoke settles and players have been moved around, et cetera.
Yeah, and we're also heading up on the point in the season where guys are going to start getting their levels changed within their organizations. When you are, like, process-wise, and this can be about the Jays or it can be about any of the teams you're doing the reporting and checking for. How much are you weighing different factors? Like obviously you would have talked to a lot of people over the course of spring training, visiting those complexes and things like that. We now have 2 months worth of game data and at some levels, some of the more underlying Statcast data and things like that. And then obviously, like you said, you're watching games, you're talking to other people in the industry. How do you weigh all those things together? Kind of what is your personal process for, hey, I'm going to take a look at Blake Murphy. I had him here before the season. Here's what I'm hearing. Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what the numbers say.
Yeah, and I think, the first part of it is, I try to stay immersed, particularly the Blue Jays, to cover you guys year-round, one of my favorite systems to cover. You're my son's favorite team. there's a lot of focus on the Jays in this house, but, I see as many players as I possibly can. I see him during spring training. I go to as many Buffalo or New Hampshire games as I can, try to catch other affiliates when I'm out of town. And that's really the same for any organization. And, I'm not going to be able to get out to Vancouver, but I can get home from the park and pop on a Vancouver game and watch the broadcast and get a pretty good idea for how guys are performing, what they look like, how they move, do all those things. Obviously we're looking at the underlying numbers in terms of the performance, the baseball card stats, all that sort of thing. But it doesn't necessarily outweigh scout feedback or the underlying data that we're getting on the StatCast side. We've been fortunate enough to have contacts that have provided us information for the last several years. So we're able to see a lot of that stuff throughout the entire minor leagues, not just, you know, the Florida State League and AAA and some of the ones that are publicly available. So that helps tremendously. And I think, you know, I try to inform myself about all the players and how they're performing, the things that they do well, the things that they don't do well, and the things I have questions about. Can they improve this in the future? And then I kind of come loaded with questions, whether I'm talking to somebody internally with the Jays front office, whether I'm talking to opposing scouts with, you know, rival teams that are, you know, assigned to the Blue Jay system and see a lot of these players. And those guys are located all throughout the country. And you get a good idea. I mean, there's some players that there's obviously big disagreements on, even between opposing scouts. Some guys may love a particular player. Other guys may not be as high. So it's kind of weighing all that together and then sort of figuring out, all right, this is where the temperature is. I think that's a big part of it, is just sort of taking the temperature of the entire industry, factoring in some of the numbers, but really informing myself before I get on calls with these guys so I know as much about these players as I possibly can, because then I can ask better questions.
All right, so let's hope I'm asking those better questions of you that you have already asked of other people, and you can pass it on for us a little bit here. Okay, let's take a look at the New Hampshire Fisher Cats first, because you're based fairly close to there. That's a team that you see a lot. It also happens to be kind of the more interesting of the Blue Jays farm teams, I think, just because we know the guys at AAA a little bit more, and AA, some of these guys are kind of in make or break spots. We had Adam Macko on the show last week. I DM'd with you after, and you'd said he's really rounding into form. What have you seen from Macko this season? I know the ERA is still kind of hovering, you know, high threes to low fours, but a lot of swing and miss stuff. He's stayed healthy. He's been able to pitch regularly. What are you liking from Macko so far this season?
Yeah, I think, you know, he is a player where it's sort of the entirety of the arsenal. And the fact that he's left-handed, you know, there is some power there, particularly for a lefty. It's not the craziest pitch shapes in the world, but it's a deceptive arm action. He keeps guys off balance. You know, he's got the four-seam where he's got the slider. He's got a curveball variation and then the changeup as well. And, you know, all of those pitches have, I'll say, average or better miss rates. You know, he's about 25% miss rate on the four seam, and that's with a high swing rate. So, you know, that's good to see. Guys are swinging 55% of the time, but they're also missing about 25% of the time. Slider and curveball are kind of his best swing and miss pitches, but, you know, really the slider, curveball, and changeup all show the ability to miss bats pretty consistently. You know, he does a great job of commanding the curveball and the slider, where the changeup and the curveball a little bit more, you know, chase pitches. So I really think, you know, it's primarily that four seam and that slider, and he uses that curveball and the changeup once he gets ahead in the count. There's pitchability there. You know, I don't think it's a mid rotation guy, but I do think this is somebody that, you know, could be a potential back end of the rotation guy within a year for the Blue Jays. And, you know, I still think when you look at someone like this that has feel for a variety of pitches, he's got some feel for spin as well. And he's a lefty, you look at a guy like that and go, all right, like this is somebody that potentially can get to the big leagues and can improve, can get stronger, can add velocity, can change pitch shapes. I think, you know, when you look at pitchers versus hitters in this process, hitters are often sort of ready-made. There's some adjustment, you know, those first 1,000 plate appearances or whatever. But you can have a guy who's a pitcher in the major leagues for 5 or 6 years and then figure something out and changes the stripes, you know. And we see it all the time. I mean, you see someone like Garrett Crochet that I think everyone had written him off as the White Sox simply as a reliever. Now he's been, you know, a really good rotation piece for them this season, despite their lack of success. Kind of an interesting player, maybe somebody they can trade and get some decent prospects for. And then kind of have on the other side a guy like Charlie Morton, where I feel like Charlie Morton wasn't even good until he was like 30. So I think with a lot of these guys, it's tough for me to say like, oh, this is where it's going to end up. Much more so, I have a lot less certainty than I do with hitters. But I think he's a guy that's going to get there. He's going to get his opportunity in the major leagues. He is left-handed. He throws a bunch of different pitches. He can mix pitch shapes. And that's the stuff that matters. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting piece to see where it goes and if they can fully develop it from there.
So on the hitter side, there are a couple guys you mentioned, you know, after 1,000 pro plate appearances or so, guys tend to be a little bit more stable in who they are. The Jays have also had some success drafting the guys who are a little bit more projectable, you know, hit tool, maybe not as much upside, but quicker through the minors. And we saw one of those guys get promoted to AAA the other day in Alan Roden. He was hitting .267 with 7 home runs and 6 stolen bases for AA New Hampshire. That was his second time through New Hampshire. What have you heard about Roden and you know, his readiness for that AAA level? He's another one of those guys like, hey, maybe there's not a ton of home run potential, but he never strikes out, takes a walk, might hit for average. He feels like kind of a fairly, and multi-position, a fairly typical high minors Jays prospect.
Yeah, and you know, I think the thing about him that's so unique is the hit tool, the actual ability to make contact is outlier. This season, in terms of swing and miss in the zone, so in the strike zone, he has a 6.1% zone miss, which is elite, elite, elite. That's like an 80 grade type of number. That's the type of stuff you were seeing from like an Isaac Paredes when he was in the minor leagues. And I think there's some parallels there. Paredes was a guy that was bigger, stronger, Roden stronger, bigger, but the swing wasn't necessarily optimized for power. There were some changes that were made. He was able to get into his pull side power a little bit more. A better defender, a better athlete than I think you would think when you just see him, because Roden is sort of boxy, sort of stocky. He's a really good corner outfielder. Probably could play some center in a pinch that you probably wouldn't want to do it. I think he can be an above average corner outfielder. Great contact. You know, 25% chase rate. He rarely chases. But he does swing. It's not like he's overtly passive. I think it's a great approach. It's a great hit tool. The underlying power isn't great. 103 mile per hour, 90th percentile, which is about what the average is. Did hit a ball 110 this year. But the contact grades out as easy plus. I think the swing decisions are above average. And I think some of it is just elevating on his best contact. He's not somebody that, you know, he hits a lot of line drive. There's not a lot of fly balls. Some of that I think is the setup, kind of higher hands. He's made some adjustments there this season that I think have allowed him to get to the ball a little bit quicker. But he's a good player. And, you know, I wouldn't expect the Davis Schneider sort of power outbreak that we saw with him. But I think he's a guy that could come up and really be a stabilizing force in like a corner outfield spot, you know, hit 275, 280, get on base, give you really good at-bats. And, you know, I had thrown this out there last year, but I had said coming into the season, I thought he was a better version of what Nolan Schanuel is, that he could have more success than Schanuel, was a better athlete, and, of course, was multi-positional and can play in the outfield and can run a little bit more than Schanuel. So I still stick by that I think he's the better version of that player. And I think we're starting to see it kind of started a little slow with New Hampshire. It's cold up there. Ball doesn't carry as much as it does in some other places. As soon as it started to warm up, he got hot a few weeks ago, and he's been rewarded.
So his teammate, kind of an infield version of him, and Josh Kasevich, again, similar, a little on the older end as a prospect, so 23 at AA here in his first year, whereas Roden's 24 and just got promoted to AAA. You had Kasevich one spot ahead of Roden on the Blue Jays' farm system rankings just before this year, and he's hitting .311 at AA, even less power, only 3 home runs there, but he has hit 13 doubles, steals a couple bases, another guy with a good line drive rate. Oversimplification to say he's like an infield version of Roden?
No, I think there's some parallels there. Kasevich is interesting to me. I actually think there might be more power projection with Kasevich. Okay. Than there is with Roden. He actually has a 47.9, 48% hard hit rate. So not, like almost 50% of his balls in play are over 95 plus. And he does that while having an almost identical zone miss rate, 6.4%. And I mean, when I talk about other teams, I don't see numbers like this. You know, 6.4% is kind of reserved for those kind of elite hit tool guys that are in low A. You don't see that at the higher levels. Lower miss rate than Roden has, similar chase rate. Like I said, hits the ball just a little bit harder. They are very similar. In a lot of ways, I think he might even be a better contact hitter than Rodon is. He's a really good defender. I don't know if he's your everyday shortstop, but he has that up-the-middle potential that I think Rodon does not have. He's a better athlete, better body than Rodon. I've talked to scouts that think this is an everyday guy, and there's potential for Kasevich to maybe get to like 15 to 16, 17 home runs at peak because of how hard he hits the ball. And you could probably trade a little – he's got so much contact, you could probably trade a little bit of that contact for a little bit more power, a little bit more loft without ruining the swing. And you have a really good, well-rounded player that does a lot of things well in the field and can really play all three outfield – I mean, all three primary outfield positions in terms of – and infield positions in terms of third base, shortstop, second base. He's too good defensively. You're not going to throw him at first, but I don't think he would have an issue doing it. He's probably been the player in season watching the Jays that I've been most impressed with this year. He's made a big jump. He's going to move up another couple spots in the updated rankings. I think this was a great pick, and I was actually talking to a Jays amateur scout at the Cape on Saturday, and we agreed that we think Kasevich is probably the best pick from that year's draft.
Yeah, and that was a 2022 draft where there were a lot of guys: Kay Doughty, Tucker Tolman. That was the Barry era. I mean, we obviously haven't seen much of him.
I mean, I've seen all those guys, saw Barriere before he got injured. You know, it's really unfortunate. Hoping that kid makes a full recovery. Hate to see that.
So I wanted to ask you two quick ones on this AA team before we move off. Sure. Trenton Wallace is 25 at AA, and this is his second time through. So, you know, we got to put a little bit of a caveat there. But he also, I know, doesn't have, you know, doesn't light up the radar gun and things like that. But a 2.95 ERA and a 30% strikeout rate, those are going to catch my eye regardless of what the kind of qualifiers are there. What have you seen from Trenton Wallace? You know, is there much there, or is the fastball just not good enough?
You know, it's really deceptive. He's an enigma. He's one of these guys where you see him, you're kind of like, I don't know what this stuff is. I don't know if this guy's going to be anything. And he kind of lulls you to sleep. And then you look up and it's like, it's the sixth inning and he's allowed three hits and a walk and one run. And he's kind of dominating, you know, but doing it while, you know, sitting low 90s. It's a funny arm action. It's a funny release point. He mixes the two seam, the slider, and the changeup really, really well. So it's really hard to sort of knock it. I just don't know where it fits. It seems more like it's an emergency depth starter, maybe a long relief guy that has, you know, some qualities that work because he has some wiggle on these pitches. You know, plus he throws a decent amount of strikes. It's funny, he's not like a crazy command maven either. But I think everything's kind of around the zone. He keeps guys off balance. He gets a decent amount of chases. It's a really funny one. You know, it's one of those where I don't fully sort of know how to break it down and if it's a major leaguer. But he's having a lot of success right now, and you can't fully write that off. But yeah, it is unusual. It's an unusual mix.
He sounds like the kind of guy who would shut down the Blue Jays offense for six innings, really. last one from that Fisher Cats team. Eric Pardino was a guy who you guys at Baseball America back in 2019 had rated as the number four prospect in the Blue Jays system. Injuries and poor performance have gone so far that in 2023 and 2024, he was not even ranked. So we're talking from over the course of 4 years, he went from the number four prospect in the system to just the guy totally off the radar. Now, I know generally it is tough for a relief prospect to move the needle, and he's been firmly in the bullpen for 3 years now, but he has a 1.01 ERA this year and a 35% strikeout rate. Are you seeing anything that tells you Pardino could be a part of a major league bullpen in the near future?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the better relief prospects I've seen this year. And it was funny because the first time he came into a New Hampshire game, it was kind of a novelty, like, oh, you know, it's Pardino. Been forever. I remember when this guy was pitching for, you know, 16 years old for Brazil on the WBC, and, you know, here we are. And then it was like first fastball was 96 mile per hour with ride. It was like, oh, that's new. I haven't seen that. It's filthy. He and Connor Cook are two guys. I think TJ Brock can probably get mixed thrown into this mix too. I think all these guys are going to be long-term major league relievers, whether that's with the Jays or with another team. It's legitimate stuff. The four seam is missing a lot of bats, 33.3% miss rate. That's well above average for a four seam fastball. Same thing with a slider, 40% miss rate on the slider. The changeup, which he throws about evenly with a slider, that might be his best pitch. He's got 44% miss rate on that pitch. It's a really good pitch. It's in the strike zone 76% of the, it's a strike 76% of the time. So he's getting a lot of misses on that pitch. High rate of chases, 45% chase rate on that pitch. And it's got enough sort of dynamic movement that when guys are chasing on that, they're not making contact. And if they are, you know, they're sort of shooting it off, you know, either at foul or, you know, weak ground balls, weak contact. It wouldn't shock me if he's in the Jays bullpen by August. Like I said, as long as the strikes are there, so far they have been. The fastball command isn't great, but it's got wiggle, it's got power. He's going to be able to overpower guys with that. I'd be interested to see how he performs at AAA, which we know those automatic zones are tricky. But I think that's a level that he should see soon and probably should prepare him, you know, for some opportunity in the Jays bullpen, maybe later this year or early next year. He's been one of the most dynamic relief prospects I've seen this season. And the Jays have a lot of those guys. The Jays have some really good relief prospects, like I said, with him, TJ Brock, and then one of my favorites in Connor Cook.
Yeah, and TJ Brock, who just came off the IL for New Hampshire, so we hadn't heard much of him from this year, but obviously a guy worth watching. So one of the names that, if any of these AA guys get promoted, one of the names who could come up from high A to kind of backfill, and this would be as a starter, is Ryan Jennings. So Jennings is about to turn 25, so another guy who's a little bit old for, you know, his level, but another guy, again, from that 2022 draft class who got almost nothing as a fourth-round signing bonus. He has a 193 ERA over his first nine starts here at high A. This a case of him just being too polished for high A as a kind of overdraft 25-year-old here, or is something clicking here for Ryan Jennings?
Yeah, I think there's always been stuff there. And when you talk to scouts that cover the Jays system, he was a guy that got consistent arrow up feedback, and he was kind of lurking outside the top 30 coming into the year. I had seen him a little bit last year, saw him, you know, down in Dunedin. And the fastball quality is really good. It's funny because he's not missing as many bats with that pitch. I think there's some command issues. Just with the fastball command, as he starts to tighten that up, I think he's really going to take a big step forward. He's an interesting one. He's somebody that I do think could be, I would probably have up in New Hampshire now. It's kind of shocking he's not. But fast, you know, fastball, four-seamer, decent ride on it. Good slider that he's missing a lot of bats with. He'll mix in a curveball as well. Sort of varied shape there, and he'll show a changeup too. I mean, it's a deep pitch mix, but I think that four seam slider, you know, mixing in the curveball is a different look here and there, mixing in the changeup look here and there could really work out of a pen. He's another guy where I think, you know, he's probably starter for a little bit, but potentially could be a good bullpen piece when he's ready to sort of matriculate to the major leagues.
Last one here for you, Jeff, before I let you go. We'll move off the 2022 draft class to the 2023 draft class. Jaron Watts Brown has made 10 starts at A-ball with Dunedin, 3.26 ERA, a strikeout rate just over 30%. You know, obviously an interesting guy in his first pro turn here, but as a third round pick, as a guy debuting at A-ball, what have you liked? What have you seen? What have you heard on Jaron Watts Brown?
Yeah, so he's a guy who's going to move up the lift a little bit. Not a huge jump, but a little bit of a decent jump, hopping in front of some other pitchers that might be hurt or just underperforming. You know, I think the biggest thing with Jaron is consistency in his pitch shapes. He's a guy that you'll watch in a given start, and you'll see some really good fastballs, and then you'll see some fastballs where he doesn't quite get behind it. That's something that's been an issue for him. Since he was an underclassman at college, he came out here on the Cape. It was kind of similar. You get a great start. It can be a little Jekyll and Hyde. The thing that I've seen in terms of improvement since he's become a professional is the consistency with the secondaries, the slider, the curveball, the changeup. And the numbers are backing that. He's got a 44% miss rate on the slider. He's got a 55% miss rate on the curveball. He's got a 54% miss rate on the changeup. The strikes and the changeup aren't great, but decent chase pitch. Strikes are a little bit better on the other two breaking balls. And actually, his slider is his best pitch. It's the pitch that he commands the best. And it doesn't blow you away when you see it, but it's one that he lands consistently, lands in the right spots. He's somebody that's moving up. I would expect him to see some promotions as the summer goes along. He's an interesting arm, and I think one that, for a college guy that had some notoriety, that pitched in the Cape, that pitched in some big conferences, he's somebody that still is a little bit projectable, that you're like, he's not totally there yet. There's still some more. I think it's, he can get stronger, get some more consistency on that fastball. We'll sort of see what Jerron Watts Brown is. But the secondary so far this year have been really good for him.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. It's nice that there are some success stories brewing on the pitching side at the lower levels of the minors, because obviously one of the stories of the last 2 years for the Blue Jays has been that they haven't been there at the higher levels of the minors. So that's great to hear. Jeff, always great to hear from you. Good luck with the updates. Can't wait for the updated top 30 in a couple weeks here.
Thanks a lot, Blake. We'll talk soon.
Jeff Ponce of Baseball America. Make sure you're keeping an eye out for those updated lists. I'm sure we'll have Jeff on again when that updated top 30 drops. But yeah, it's every time we have these conversations with Jeff or with Doug Fox or any of the other scout people, you do get a pretty clear view of the way the Jays have valued and tried to develop hitters, less so on the pitching side. And this is, I think, probably not unique to the Blue Jays, that every pitcher is kind of his own thing, and you're not going to apply, you know, universal pitching philosophy to your entire prospect pitching staff. But it is always interesting, the variability pitcher to pitcher versus, you know, when you talk about four or five hitters in a row, you can start to see some similarities. Okay, the positional flexibility. Okay, this team obviously values an ability to make contact on swings in the zone. Swing decisions come up. Yeah, exit velocity is nice, but, you know, a lot of the top hitting prospects don't necessarily have a ton of natural home run power. And then you look at what the Blue Jays have done at the major league level. You look at who they've graduated. Things, there is at least like a consistency there. Now, not a consistency that's delivered production and strength at the major league level just yet, but we'll see as, you know, guys like Kasevich, guys like Alan Roden continue to move through the system, if they're right, that those guys can translate to the major leagues pretty easily there. We're going to take a break. Text us in, by the way, to 590-590. You can always text us in. We'll try to save them for throughout the week. We'll also continue to tee up this Jays Red Sox series, including Nick Pivetta against Yusei Kikuchi on his birthday tonight. We'll tee up that one. We're going to take a break. We'll talk to Davey Andrews of Fangraphs on the other side. We'll take some of your texts to 590-590 as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, little mountain goats for you and for our next guest, Davey Andrews of Fangraphs. And I believe I've collected the entire Subway Ghosts band now as Jays Talk Plus guest. Davey, good morning, man. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Was that bump music for me? Because that is one of my favorite records. That's John Vanderslice with the Mountain Goats.
Yeah, I mean, I picked it out because I knew you liked the Mountain Goats. Yeah, that's for you. By the way, have you gotten a record deal yet off the Edward Julian song and, you know, viral clip there?
You know, I am open to offers.
That's great. Davey, of course, plays in Subway Ghosts with Mike Petriello, who's a regular here, and a couple of other baseball writer types. Davey, you have spent a month also playing around with backtracking data that we now have available. You've done a number of pieces on those. Have some specifics for you, but let's start at a high level. You have dove into this stuff a lot. You've run a lot of correlations, told some stories from it. What, start at a high level, what have we been able to kind of glean from this? What have we learned from the early availability of this stuff?
Well, I think the first thing we learned is that it's very complicated. You know, we kind of go backwards from, we started out caring about a player's batting average, and then we kind of looked at things more holistically. We included their on base and slugging. So we now have a picture of how they're performing as a whole. And then we went from results into process. So we went to exit velocity and we looked at ground ball rate versus fly ball rate and that sort of thing. And now we're really even a step further from results. We're very deep into the process in terms of not just how hard you hit the ball, but how hard you're capable of hitting the ball, which is oftentimes what bat speed measures. And I think we've learned a bunch of things. But the first one is that it's a complicated science. And the people over Baseball Savant are much, much smarter than I am. So that's the first one. I think there are a bunch of interesting things going on. You know, the first thing that we look at is bat speed, which makes a lot of sense. And you see Giancarlo Stanton way up at the top because he is, you know, just a bat speed monster. He hits the ball hard and he swings hard no matter what. And then at the bottom, you have Luis Arraez. And so I think the first thing we learned when you see those two, Stanton at the top and Arraez at the bottom, is that things work kind of how we've always intuitively thought they did. That if you swing hard, you are going to swing and miss a lot. And if you swing softer, you're going to have a shorter swing, but you're going to be able to make a lot more contact. So that was a basic one. But then if you flip it around, you see that the pitcher matters a lot. Ben Clemens, who writes over at Fangraphs with me, he dove a lot into the pitching side, and he saw that fastballs, where you would think the batter needs to speed up their bat and hit a lot harder, it doesn't work that way. Players take shorter swings. They're scared of fastballs. They swing much softer on fastballs. So there's some really interesting stuff. And then you saw Robert Orr over at Baseball Prospectus discovered that inside pitches and low and outside pitches require a longer swing, just because physically you have to turn your body in a certain way to get to them or reach out to that low and outside pitch. So there are a lot of details obscuring it. When you see a guy has a long swing or a fast swing, you need to say, does he have that swing because he's choosing pitches that cause him to swing that way? Or is that the way it works? One of the things I looked at was player height and to see how that determines it. You know, we always talk about a player with long levers can make a lot of contact. And like, if you look at O'Neill Cruz, who is 6'8 and has, you know, just the longest arms imaginable, he has a very long swing. But if you plot it by height and then get a correlation, he actually has a much smaller, much shorter, more compact swing than you would expect for someone as big as he is. So there's a lot of nuance here. And so we've learned a lot of things. And I think we've just also learned how complicated it is to be a hitter in the big leagues right now.
Yeah, my two biggest takeaways from reading all of your stuff and Ben's and Robert's and everyone else's is, one, hitting is really, really hard. And two, yes, we kind of have to, like, it strikes me that at least for right now, this stuff is all super fascinating descriptively to go in and look at what makes Luis Arraez Luis Arraez, what makes O'Neill yes. Cruz O'Neill Cruz. But prescriptively, in terms of like, hey, like, yes, similar to fastball velocity, all else equal, you'd rather have a faster bat than a slower bat. But there exactly. is so much individual, hey, what is this guy's approach? What is his style? What is he trying to do? You know, there is so we're going to have to treat every player, you know, individually and really look at the descriptive story for the time being. That's a fair kind of read on the body of work so far.
Absolutely. And I think we also need to keep in mind that, one, these are all very small sample sizes. We've only had this data for a month or two. But two, that we are looking at the very, very tiny top of the pyramid, that when we make sweeping generalizations off this data, we need to remember that we're only talking about the very best hitters who have made it. It would look different if we had all of the minor league data or college data. You know, the exit velocity and bat speed, they matter a huge deal. But because you can't get to the big leagues without them, it's sometimes hard to tell just how much it matters. You know, I think when exit velocity data came out, we saw that scouts cared about it a great deal. People right away, you could extrapolate a lot just from knowing the hardest a guy can hit a ball or their 90th percentile exit velocity, which is where you just look at when they're hitting the ball the hardest that they possibly can, their top 10%. What does that mean? It turns out that that data mattered a great deal. So it's important to keep in mind, we're only looking at people who already have these great skills. If we're looking at prospects and stuff, we're going to need a little more time and a little more data to know how much it matters and what way we dice up the numbers to look at it to get a sample that means something.
Yeah, a real selection bias when we're only looking at the top 1% of the top 1% of the top 1% of baseball right. playing population. Yeah, and that, you know, there are a lot of interesting things we're going to learn more about. You mentioned the, hey, longer swing to something high and inside. I remember, like, maybe 2013-ish, someone at Beyond the Box Score wrote about effective velocity and how a fastball up and in, because it takes you longer, yes, to get there. That 94 is maybe more like 95. And now we, you know, StatCast has perceived velocity, which takes into account the extension down the mound and how closely you're releasing the ball, but maybe this is something we learn more about now as well. Hey, your bat path has to go, absolutely, longer to get to this, so the fastball plays up there, that kind of thing.
Right. I think that's a big thing, looking at the data and seeing who was where. And especially, I tried to pull some numbers, and it's just, you have to get your sample so precise. You can't look at all pitches. So I was like looking at data where I was looking at only four-seam fastballs and only right over the heart of the plate, and only balls that were squared up, just because otherwise you're going to contaminate it with half swings or things that make the numbers bad. So I think looking at it that way, I think what you're going to see is what scouts talk a lot about: barrel variability, the ability to get your barrel on a pitch up and in and down away and to move your torso. They talk a lot about flexibility and athleticism, and that's not always apparent in baseball players versus some other sports. But I think that this data is going to help us put a number to that. He's athletic, and I know that because he can generate bat speed low and outside, or he can generate bat speed on an up and in pitch, that sort of thing. So I think a lot of this stuff is just advanced scouting. It's stuff that scouts have been doing for decades. They know with their eyes, and all of a sudden a camera can finally move fast enough to see it too.
And that makes us all more efficient, right? It lets us who can't be at all of those minor league games at every major league game have a chance at capturing it and talking about it. And for them, I'm sure it speeds up, like at the team level, you know, it speeds up the process. Like these teams have not, you know, it's not the money ball scene where the scouts, like, they're trading in scouts for analytics. That's not how it works in actuality, unless you're like the most broke boy of the franchises, you know, or the team, you know. Yeah, we'll call it the White Sox and the Rockies and the Athletics. We know who they are. Okay. So another thing that you, and this is more what you wrote about the other day or last week rather at Fangraphs, is this trend over the last 15 years, maybe, of just pull it in the air. And, you know, there's the book, The MVP Machine, that focuses on Justin Turner when he kind of first broke out with the Dodgers, that, hey, I'm just going to catch it out front a little bit more, and that's going to help me pull it in the air. You did a deeper dive into what catching it out front means with this new, you know, hey, you've got to change your swing and you've got to be real quick with that bat to catch it out front. What was kind of your takeaway from that? Hey, just pull it in the air, but it's not really about pulling it in the air necessarily. It's more about the mechanics of what catching it out front looks like.
Right. Well, so that was, I mean, we called it the fly ball revolution or the launch angle revolution. That was around the time that I was starting to read Fangraphs and all these sites intensely. I was reading your work, and, you know, and so people talked about it as get out front, because your swing, naturally, you hold your bat up at your shoulder and then it dips down into the strike zone and goes back up to your other shoulder. So every swing goes down, up, down. And so the thought was, if you're catching it out back, if you're hitting it the other way, then your bat is going down and you're going to hit the ball on the ground. And if you catch it out front, your bat is going up and you're going to hit a fly ball or a line drive. And so we talked about it much more as just put it in the air and good things will happen, because a fly ball is better than a ground ball. But what the bat tracking data has kind of enabled us to see for the first time is that there's another big positive to going out and catching the ball out front, is that your bat accelerates through the zone the whole way. Like, if you just practice miming a swing in your house, you'll find that you're pushing the bat forward until it's way out in front. You know, you push off the ground and you use your glutes, and all these players get, you know, they tear their obliques, and because they're using every part of them. You know, we talk about players who have really strong wrists and forearms. And so catching the ball out front also means hitting the ball harder. So I kind of diced up the data by, if you hit the ball to first base or second base or shortstop or third base, where are bats moving fastest? And it was kind of always to the pull side. The further out you can catch the ball, the harder you can hit it. And so it was sort of, maybe the launch angle revolution was more about just hitting the ball harder, and that just also happens to mean putting it in the air to the pull side.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to think about that. It's like, yeah, you want to pull it in the air, but actually the best way to pull it in the air is probably a more process-oriented thing, a level down of catching the ball out front. So I wonder, and I'll use Justin Turner as an example, both because he was a key figure in the MVP machine, the Ben Lindbergh book, that kind of went into how teams and players are trying to build the next, you know, round of hitters and the launch angle revolution, things like that. When you see a guy who has been synonymous with that struggling a little bit, and sorry to put you on the spot if you haven't looked at Turner particularly, so feel free to generalize, but what do you make of that? Someone who, you know, maybe doesn't have the bat speed to catch something out front anymore, and that has been a core part of their the way that they succeed.
Right. Well, I think that is a concern. And I did, you know, I looked at Turner's numbers a bit before I came on. And so that is often what we talk about, what Turner did and what, you know, he learned from Marlon Byrd and Doug Lotta, the kind of the swing guru behind a lot of that theory, is, you know, going out and meeting the ball early and hitting the ball in the air to the pole side. That is often kind of the last refuge of an aging slugger. And it was because you have to guess a little more. Going out to meet the ball early means starting your swing earlier. And that works for a lot of people. You know, in Toronto, you have Joey Bautista, who is an amazing example of that. He kind of wasn't a great hitter until someone told him, just start your swing earlier. And all of a sudden, he was a home run machine. But so that move is something that older players do when they don't have the bat speed. And Turner, as a young guy, was a contact guy without amazing bat speed. And that turned him into a great power hitter. But he still, even when he was hitting home runs all the time, he didn't hit the ball that hard. He optimized the contact that he did make. And so now you look at his numbers and it's very scary. I think he's been a little bit unlucky. You know, his batting average on balls in play is .256. And he's almost always been above .300 over the last 12 years of his career. So it seems like maybe he's a little unlucky. But he's also, his hard hit rate is 29, and it was at 39 last year. His exit velocity is down 3%, and his 90th percentile exit velocity is down 4%. These are enormous drops. You know, a 3% change or 3 mile per hour change in exit velocity is the difference between, in Turner's case, an average player and around the bottom of the league. So it's scary stuff. That and you know, he's already kind of doing, he's, there's not another change you could make. This is kind of the way that you swing when you're maximizing every last drop out of the swing that you have. There's not another step. There were a couple reasons that I saw for optimism that you could bounce back a bit, but it's a little scary right now.
This doesn't have to be particular to Turner. And of course, we only have 2.5 months of this stuff. We don't have year over year. Right. I got warned that, you know, there's a back end way to see last year's bat speed stuff. I got told don't use it. It wasn't fully calibrated and stuff like that. I still peek sometimes just out of curiosity, but I got told it's not calibrated the same. Don't use it, whatever. But yeah. Longer term, like when we're 2-3 years down the line, how much do you think this bat, like, and not just bat speed, all of these new metrics of things, but bat speed, for lack of a better catch-all, will help us understand the batter aging process?
I think it will be huge because, especially for that, you can kind of cherry pick. You can look at only when a guy crushes the ball, only when he barrels it up and hits it over 95 or something like that. So you're going to get something similar to like max exit velocity, where you can really see what is a player capable of. And with that, when you're talking about exit velocity, you need to see them hit the ball absolutely perfectly, which just, even for the best hitters, doesn't happen all that often. But now you can see what is the hardest this man could possibly swing. You can get that in a day or two, you know, that you have enough swings per game that we'll find that out very quickly. And I think hopefully you'll be able to see when something's wrong. It might help us kind of see an injury coming a little bit.
Yeah, that has to be the hope, you know, similar to the way we can use velocity and break and spin rate and all that stuff on the pitcher side. We just have so much more on the pitchers, even though batting is the more difficult thing. Davey, right, man, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. Keep up all the great work.
All right, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Davey Andrews of Fangraphs. Make sure you head over there and read just a really good entire series contextualizing a lot of this new bat speed stuff. Him and Ben Clemens, our pal Robert Orr over at Baseball Prospectus. We let Davey go a minute early there because we have some texts from you, but also we have some news. Joey Votto has been sent on a rehab assignment to the Florida Complex League Blue Jays. So we are finally getting there. With Joey Votto getting into game action, potentially. He is not in their lineup today. They're playing right now. But thanks to Thomas Hall for alerting us that the Jays have officially moved Votto to the FCL Blue Jays for a rehab stint. We'll get more on that from John Schneider pregame today. We'll also look for that Jimmy Garcia update as well. That'll probably be around 4 o'clock. So keep an eye on Twitter and tune into Blair and Barker, of course, at 4 o'clock for more on that. It is the first of three tonight down at Rogers Center. All three are 7 o'clock starts. No afternoon starts this week. So the Red Sox here for three. It's Yusei Kikuchi against Nick Pivetta tonight. Chris Bassett against Tanner Houck tomorrow. Kevin Gausman against Brian Bayo on Wednesday. We talked a little bit about Pivetta earlier on. 388. Why am I having so much trouble saying 88 today? No idea. Sorry, Eric Lindros. A really solid strikeout rate, low-ish walk rate, but Pivetta's a guy who has always had trouble with the home run. That's especially true outside of Fenway, which is a little interesting given how team-friendly or how hitter-friendly Fenway tends to play. There's an interesting thing underlying the Red Sox offensive numbers with that, too, where they don't hit a ton of home runs, but they do get dinged for Fenway as a park factor because they just hit so many more doubles because of the Fenway dimensions. Anyway, Red Sox still very good overall, 10th in runs scored per game, 10th in runs allowed per game, and yeah, top 10 in both starter and bullpen ERA. Nick Pivetta, 388 ERA, and yeah, throws his four-seamer a lot. Other than Mason Miller, it grades out as the best fastball in the league from a stuff plus perspective. That's because of that rise, that kind of, hey, it stays up in the zone and gets in on you, as they say. If we look at Pivetta's history, very minor reverse platoon splits this year. Historically, he has normal splits. I don't put a ton of stock into reverse splits in a small sample anyway. The Jays have also seen Pivetta a lot, so they know what to expect, even though the fastball is good. 185 plate appearances for the Jays on the roster against Pivetta. 304 batting average, 397 weighted on base average, 9 homers. Bo Bichette, particularly a guy to look for, even though he hasn't always handled those rising fastballs super well this year, he's 10 for 32 against Pivetta with a pair of home runs and almost a 600 slugging against his career. Vlad has hit 3 home runs off Pivetta and walked a bunch. George Springer has pretty good numbers against Nick Pivetta in his career. Pivetta started against the Jays 3 times last year, 14 innings with a 450 ERA and did give up 4 home runs. On the other side, it's Yusei Kikuchi's birthday, so he gets a little birthday start down at Rogers Center. He has done a good job. So Kikuchi's a lefty. He has platoon splits. Righties hit him better. But that is more about how deadly he's been to lefties than anything else. Lefties have a 416 OPS against Yusei Kikuchi this year, which is ridiculous. So even though he does have platoon splits, it's not as if righties are crushing him. He's also done a much better job this year compared to the last two at limiting power from righties. So that slugging percentage from righties is down significantly on breaking balls. His breaking balls have just been better this year generally, but he's been a little less predictable with them as well. The Sox saw him once last year, got to him kind of pretty well. He gave up 5 runs over 4 1/3, did strike out 7 though. That was on Canada Day last year. Devers is only 2 for 13 against them, but has homered. Rob Refsnyder and Yoshida have both had some moderate success against Kikuchi as well. Their team in 41 plate appearances, a 297 average. So it'll be interesting to see how this one shakes out. I'm going to save most of your texts that were in the text line for tomorrow because we've only got like 2 minutes left on the show. But we will take one from Nick in Toronto who says, with the Red Sox running game in town, how much do you attribute controlling the running game to pitchers varying their times to the plate and over throwing over with intent? Varying times can help. If you are a slow, that's easier to do though. If you are a pitcher who's fast to the plate, if you are a pitcher who's slow to the plate, like Kevin Gausman, it can be tough to vary them too much because the pitch clock will get to you. Chris Bassett, very, very good at changing his tempo and his times to the plate to mess with runners and hitters. Yusei Kikuchi, very good move over to first base. Now, a lot of the time he just steps off. He doesn't actually throw over, but when he does throw over, it's a good move. He's also quick to the plate. This is one of those things where I think and this goes back to like decades and decades and decades in baseball, that you steal off the pitcher, you get thrown out by the catcher. The more and more data we get on this stuff and the more we can look at it, the more I think that's pretty accurate. If you're JT Realmuto, yeah, you got a great pop time and you can fire one down to second, but the runner is going to be able to steal off the pitcher. They're going to be able to get that extended lead. They're going to be able to time them up and go. Your catcher's trying to erase that mistake for your pitcher. Malcolm and Barry asked, Barger looked good over the weekend. Is he here to stay? I think so. You know, that 1 for 18 that he had when he was up last, I thought that was, you know, hey, it was his first cup of coffee in the major leagues. He went back down to the minors and looked even better in the areas you'd like him to look in AAA. They, of course, DFA'd Vogelbach and Biggio, so it's not as if they got optioned down and they can come right back up. I think he's going to be here for a while. I think he's going to get a couple starts in this series because the Red Sox are starting three righties. He's fun. He hits the heck out of the ball. He's pretty good defensively. I don't see a good reason for him to not be up with this team. Yusei Kikuchi, Nick Pivetta tonight. Should be a blast. Dan Buck and Hazel on the call. Jamie and Joe, Blue Jay Central. And Ben and Madison on the call on the radio side. Thank you to Chris Cotillo, Chris Black, Jeff Ponce, and Davey Andrews for coming on. Thanks to Lance Kennedy and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass as always. And thanks to producer Amit Mann, and a belated happy birthday. His birthday was on Saturday. Thanks, Amit.